He currently serves on the steering committee for the Emeriti Retirement Health Program, the board of advisors for Care Gain, and on the Maryland State Planning Grant Healthcare Coverage Work Group. In 2001, Dr. Fronston served on the Institute of Medicine Subcommittee on the Status of the Uninsured. He has testified before numerous congressional committees and has appeared before over 100 groups to share his expertise on employee benefits. He has also made numerous presentations for congressional staff and the media. He earned his Bachelor of Science degree from the State University of New York, Binghamton, and his PhD in economics from the University of Miami. He told us this morning that this is not his first trip to Michigan. He's been involved in projects in Kalamazoo, Muskegon, and Flint. Dr. Fronston.
Just going to adjust this so everybody can hear me. I'm the proud recipient of a postcard from a hotel up in Muskegon 3 years ago, thanking me for being their most frequent guest. But that's only because I was traveling with a colleague, and his hotel room was in my name, so it looked like I was there about 25 nights that year. And the hotel had just opened up, so they hadn't had a lot of experience yet with lots of guests. It's a forward button. There we go. Okay. Let me just say a couple of words about EBRI before I get started, just to add on to Bob's comments. We are nonpartisan. We don't lobby. We don't take positions on policy. We're set up like a trade association supported mostly by membership dues. Our members include a combination of employers, unions, trade associations, benefit consultants, insurance companies, foundations, consumer groups, and I'm sure providers of medical services. I'm sure I'm leaving a group out there. It's a very diverse group of members. It makes it very difficult for us to take a position on public policy because in large part our members don't agree on how to solve the issues, but they do agree upon what the issues are. And they support us because they believe in our mission, which is to be an objective source of information for the media and for policymakers so that public policy can be based upon sound information. You've already seen this chart, or a different version of this chart, so in large part I'm going to ignore it. But basically what it says is that costs for healthcare are increasing faster than overall inflation, faster than worker income. And that's what's driving everything. That's what's driving all the change that we're seeing with respect to benefits in the workplace. That's the cost of those benefits. I was asked today to talk about consumerism, consumer-driven health benefits. We sort of use the terms interchangeably, consumerism on one hand and consumer-driven health benefits on the other. They actually mean different things. Consumerism is a very broad term used to define this movement towards getting consumers more engaged in their health benefits, and I've tried to provide a definition here for you. Whereas consumer-driven health benefits are one type of way of going about doing that. It's a specific kind of health plan that I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about in more detail. When it comes to consumerism, there's lots of potential for it and there's lots of concerns about it. In terms of its potential, it might lower cost. It might lower cost either because people will use fewer healthcare services or because there will be a substitution of less expensive services for more expensive services. It may result in a better engaged consumer, a more satisfied consumer if they're better engaged in getting the kind of health care that they expect to get. It may result in better health outcomes as well as more appropriate care and overall improve affordability of health care, which has other benefits, including if we reduce health care costs overall, it makes it more affordable for people that don't have access to health insurance or health care services. In terms of the concerns, there's a huge concern that people are not in a position to take more responsibility over various aspects of their health care. The Institute of Medicine has estimated that about one half of the adult population is considered health illiterate, and health care is just too complicated to ask people to become their own physician. And in some sense, that is what we are asking people to do with consumerism. There's a concern that it will reduce necessary care as well as induce demand for unnecessary care. There's a concern that while we're asking people to take more responsibility for various aspects of their health care, we're not giving them the tools and resources that they need to make informed decisions. There's a lot of uncertainty about the impact on high-cost users, where all of the spending is, and I'll talk about that more before the end of my presentation. And there's also a concern that the movement to consumerism at this point, which is a movement towards consumer-directed health plans, which has seen some positive early results from the early adopters of these plans in terms of their premiums and their costs, there's concern that those early positive results are one-time savings, similar to the one-time savings that we experienced during the mid-1990s as we moved to HMOs and managed care. There's a number of issues that state policymakers really need to consider as this movement gears up. For one, consumerism, it's about an informed consumer. It's about giving consumers the tools and resources that they need to make better decisions. Information on prices, which is relatively easy to do, not necessarily easy to do, but relatively easy to do, as well as information on quality of healthcare services, as well as outcomes, both at various provider levels. That information, some of it exists, a lot of it does not. We have to contend with the health literacy issue that I mentioned, and really support some type of benefit innovation. I believe personally that health insurance and health benefits and the way cost sharing is structured can be used to facilitate consumerism in a positive way. I don't think we're going about it at this point in a positive way, but I think we could get there, and we may need to make a number of mistakes along the way. Policymakers have a role. They have a dual role. They have a role as public policymakers in terms of facilitating the movement to consumerism, helping give this market the foundation it needs so people can make informed decisions, as well as a provider or an employer of workers that provides health benefits to workers. So it's not just in terms of the public sector and public programs, but state policymakers have a role as well in terms of what is often labeled private programs or programs for employees through private insurance. Let me give you some sense of what the consumer-directed health plans look like. At this point, there are two. They look a lot alike. There's lots of confusion as to what they are and how they work. The first one I want to talk about is known as a health reimbursement arrangement, an HRA. An HRA is often associated with a health risk appraisal as well, so it's very easy to get confused with the various acronyms out there. In this case, a health reimbursement arrangement, we first started to see these arrangements in 2001. So they're only 6 years old. The oldest ones are only 6 years old, though once in a while I'm at a conference and we're talking about these plans and someone stands up and says, I've been doing this for 35 years. But really 2001 is the beginning of these plans. They exist under current law. It did not take an act of Congress to allow employers to offer these kinds of arrangements. You could think about these plans as simply, and I'm very much oversimplifying, there's just not enough time to do justice to how these plans work. You could think about these plans as an account. Your employer is giving you money in an account that you could use to pay for out-of-pocket expenses. It could be as simple as that. And the accounts typically exist only on paper. I like to call the accounts monopoly money. Employers are giving you access to what looks like an account that exists someplace, and you could use that money to pay for your services. Employers don't actually set up accounts. It all exists on paper. It's all notional money. So basically, in a computer someplace, it says you may have $500 a year to spend on healthcare services that your employer is making available to you, but the employer doesn't set that money aside. It just pays your expenses as you incur those expenses. These accounts or arrangements, and that's why the term arrangement is used instead of account here, are often, usually, combined with a high deductible health plan. They do not have to be combined with a high deductible health plan, but they usually are. And the early plans that we saw in 2001 looked like a plan with a deductible for an individual of $2,000. but your employer made this account available to you with $1,000 in it. So really, the way the plan works in this case is that you would have $1,000 of first dollar coverage. So the first $1,000 of your health care would be covered in full if you chose to use the money in the account, which would be your choice. Which would mean if you went to the doctor in January, you would no longer have a $20 copayment. You'd pull the money out of the account to cover the full cost of the visit. Okay, so in some sense, that's a free visit. It doesn't cost you $20 anymore. Your employer's giving you money to pay for that visit. Once you use up the $1,000, then you hit what's known as this deductible gap. That's the difference between the amount of money that's being provided to you and the deductible level of $2,000. So your employer pays the first $1,000, you pay the next $1,000, and then insurance kicks in. And that insurance can look like anything. It, you know, probably look like a typical plan that, most people in this room have. The money in the account is not yours, it's your employer's. Your employer owns it. When you leave your job, your employer does not have to give you access to that money. Your employer can. It's at the employer's discretion to make that money available to you, but there's no rule regarding portability that he or she has to do that. If you don't use up the money in the account by the end of the year, well, then you can roll it over. So if you use, and most people won't use up the money in the account each year because most people, in fact, are healthy. About 50% of the population uses very little health care in any given year. So if you use $500 in year one, it means in year two, you're going to start the year with $1,500, which means that deductible gap in year two isn't $1,000 anymore, it's $500. Okay, and at some point, healthy people will get to the point where there's more money in the account than the level of the deductible. Okay, if you're not using up the money each year, you'll accumulate a balance. And that complicates things when you're trying to evaluate these plans, because over time, you're going from having a high deductible to essentially no deductible. And it changes that, and that's why I made the point before about these plans possibly inducing demand. It changes the way you think about how to use healthcare services. And we don't have enough experience with these plans, even after 5 or 6 years, to really have a sense of how that's working, because there are so few people in these plans. When it comes to preventive care, it can be carved out. Under this kind of arrangement, a health reimbursement arrangement, an employer can design the health plan any way it wants to. It could cover preventive services in full, either just by definition or up to a certain dollar amount. It can or cannot let you roll the money over. We've seen plans that have capped the amount of money that could be accumulated. So once you reach $4,000, no more money is going to go into the account until you spend down, which also creates some strange incentives to spend down money to make room for an additional contribution. So there's lots of flexibility in terms of how these plans work. These plans, it's because we had these plans that we got health savings accounts, which are the kind of plan that more people have heard about. That doesn't necessarily mean more people are familiar with them. HSAs needed an act of Congress. That took place as part of the Medicare Modernization Act in 2003. They are the most unique savings vehicle out there. They are a savings account, an account, as opposed to an arrangement. Meaning, in terms of its uniqueness, you could think about it as a 401k plan or 457 plan, where money goes into the account tax-free, whether it's your money or your employer's money. And in this case, both you and your employer can contribute. In the case of an HRA, only your employer can contribute to it. The money goes in tax-free. It builds up tax-free. You have the choice as an owner of an HSA. Once your employer puts money in your HSA, it's your money. You could decide how it's invested. With an HRA, you may not get any interest on the account. With an HSA, you could invest it in mutual funds. You could invest it in stocks. It's up to you. It's your money. The money, any accumulation in the account, interest earnings, capital gains, accumulates tax-free. You don't pay taxes on that income. When you take the money out of the account, as long as you use it for a qualified medical expense, which also includes premiums for long-term care insurance, COBRA premiums, as well as premiums for certain Medicare-eligible retirees, When you use the money in the account for those purposes, it comes out tax-free. That's the primary difference between a 401k plan and an HSA. A 401k plan, the money goes in tax-free, builds up tax-free, but when it comes out, you pay taxes on it. With an HSA, you never pay taxes on it. Okay, it's the only type of individual account that looks like that. But there are strings attached. Unlike an HRA, where it doesn't matter what level of deductible you have, even though typically they are high deductibles. With an HSA, you must have a minimum deductible of $1,100 for self-only coverage and $2,200 for family coverage in order to make a tax-free contribution. Okay, you must have that high deductible to make the contribution. You also must have a plan that caps out-of-pocket expenses at $5,500 for individuals and $11,000 for families. Contributions are limited. You cannot contribute more than $2,850 for an individual and $5,650 for a family. And that's contributions from all sources. Anybody can contribute to this account, you and your employer. So the combination of your contributions and your employer contributions cannot exceed these thresholds. And finally, there are exceptions to that where catch-up contributions are allowed once you're age 55, and the catch-up contributions are being phased in. By 2009, it will be $1,000. All of the thresholds on this slide will be indexed to inflation. So the minimum deductible is going to increase with inflation each year, the maximum out-of-pocket is going to increase with inflation each year, as well as the contributions. The one exception is the rollover, the catch-up contribution at the bottom is not indexed to inflation. So unless Congress changes the law, it will stay at $1,000 after 2009. There's two slides here. I'm not going to go into the details. It's summary slides that I want you to have in terms of comparing HRAs and HSAs. But I do want to make the point related to the previous presentation, which told you that there are 2.7 million people with these plans. It's actually 2.7 million workers with these plans through an employer. If you add in people that get an HSA on their own from an insurance company, and you add in all of the dependents that are covered by both the employment-based market and the individual market, it's been estimated that last year, somewhere between 5.5 and 6.5 million people were enrolled in one of these kinds of plans. Okay, so it's much larger than 2.7. You could argue, either way, is this a large number or a small number? Well, when you have 170 million people with private insurance coverage, this is a drop in the bucket. But you know what? Back in 2000, there was nobody with these plans. We've gone from nobody to 6 million in about 6 years. And it's growing, and it's going to continue to grow. I'm going to go through this relatively fast. I will be around for questions, but in the interest of time, we want to give plenty of time to you. There is some research that's being done to evaluate the impact of these plans. When it comes to adverse selection, I don't know how many people in this room know what adverse selection is. It basically means that these plans are not attracting the average person. And the concern with these plans is they're attracting healthier, younger people. And sort of segmenting the pool of people with insurance coverage and leaving older, less healthy people in traditional insurance, which winds up driving up their costs. So far, there's mixed evidence on whether or not there is adverse selection. When you look at adverse selection defined by age, you see no difference in the age profile of people with these new consumer-driven plans as compared to people with traditional coverage. We do find that these plans have a disproportionate number of people with higher income. No surprise, higher income people will be more likely to take a risk associated with higher cost sharing. And I think that the income effect, to some degree, mitigates adverse selection, because along with higher income people comes older people that have higher incomes that tend to have more health problems. And they're not turned off by the higher out-of-pocket expenses when they have health problems because they have higher income. So that mitigates adverse selection to some degree. But we are finding that the people in these plans, I hesitate to say choosing these plans, but the people in these plans have somewhat better health status than people in the traditional health insurance market. And I hesitate to say that these people are choosing these plans because we can't assume that people have a choice of health plan. We actually have found that people with consumer-directed plans are less likely to have a choice of health plan than people with traditional health insurance. At Ebri, we're a small business. There's more people in this room than there are working at Ebri. We don't really have a choice of health plan. If Ebri were to offer one of these plans, unless you know I opted out and got coverage through a different employer, say through my spouse's employer, I'd be in that plan. The young people in our office would be in the plan, and the older people in the office would be in the plan. Those with no health conditions would be in the plan, and those with health conditions would be in the plan. So at this point, we can't generalize adverse selection because of choices that people are making. People don't have as much choice as you think when it comes to their health insurance. In terms of the impact of these plans on healthcare spending, there have been some studies done that have simulated the impact and have found that if you just offer a high deductible plan with no account, you may see your expenses go down between 4% and 15%. It's a pretty wide range, and I think it's a pretty wide range because we're using data that predates these types of health plans. If you combine the high deductible with an account, you're looking at a 2% to 7% drop, so about half of the decline in costs. The early anecdotal evidence suggests that it's about a 10% savings, but we've seen some examples in the 20 to 25% range. I've actually seen some examples much higher than that. But I think we need to be very cautious on how we interpret this data because we've got the anecdotes, but the simulations are not based upon real data, and we don't have the long-term experience yet with the accounts. And the long-term experience is really what we need to see how a balance in the account that changes over time affects the way people use healthcare. And I'd also recommend being very cautious about the data you look at based upon where you're getting the data from. I was on a panel with someone from a large insurance company last June, and in his presentation, he showed that in 2006, they found that the consumer-driven health plan resulted in an 8% reduction in healthcare costs. I was okay with that until he told me that they were seeing only a 4% increase in their traditional plan. 4%. Employers would kill for a 4% increase. No one's talking about a 4% increase. So that concerned me. I asked him about it. He said, well, from the analysis, they excluded all the high-cost claims. That's where all the costs are. You can't exclude the claims over $50,000. That's going to be 80% of the costs. So you have to be very careful about the source. In terms of the impact of these plans on use, in some sense, the impact is all over the map. But in general, we're finding an increase in preventive care, including an increase in prescription drug use, reduced visits to the emergency room, as well as a result of that, reduced hospital admissions, reduction in acute care services, increase in office visits. The increase in office visits, I think, is what triggers the increase in drug spending, because you go to the doctor, you're more likely to walk out with a prescription. One study found an 8% reduction in costs overall, but as part of that, they found an increase in hospital admissions, but inpatient costs went down. And they said inpatient costs, even though hospital admissions went up, inpatient costs went down because people were better shoppers. I don't believe that at this point. In large part, you still have no control over prices when it comes to these plans because these plans are built on top of PPOs, and prices have already been negotiated between the health plan and the provider. You're just piggybacking over that negotiation. So, and you need to be very concerned about comparisons because of adverse selection, because of differences in health status. In terms of quality effects, I think it's important to point out that cost sharing, when you use cost sharing, a high deductible, as a tool to change quality, it's a blunt instrument. It's a blunt instrument that affects both unnecessary care as well as necessary care, and it's hard to distinguish between the two. The difference today, though, between today and in the past when it comes to these plans is we're building these plans not just on top of PPOs, but on top of managed care. Okay, there are financial incentives built into these plans to promote health, financial incentives to use disease management programs. Deductibles often do not apply to preventive care, and there are some tools and resources, though we've just seen the tip of the iceberg in terms of helping people make better decisions. When it comes to evidence on quality, the evidence so far is mixed, but it's still early on. There's lots of studies that I could go into. I'm just going to mention one because it's mine, and that's a study we've done now 2 years in a row with the Commonwealth Fund. We have found that among people with consumer-directed health plans, there's lower satisfaction with quality of care, lower satisfaction with out-of-pocket costs, and with the plan overall. We actually think that it's the cost, the out-of-pocket costs, that are driving the low satisfaction rates. And fewer people in these plans than in traditional plans would recommend them to a friend or coworker. Keep in mind that this does not mean that people are overwhelmingly satisfied with traditional health insurance. There's lots of problems there too. But in relative terms, people are less satisfied with the consumer-directed plan. And we do see that people say that those in the consumer-directed plan all the way to your right and those with the high-deductible plan without an account in the middle are more likely to say that the terms of their coverage cause them to consider costs when they're deciding to seek healthcare services. But when it comes to the kinds of services that they're seeking and doing something about, it boils down to prescription drugs. And that's no surprise. That's the easiest place to make a decision and to get information about cost, because you're at the point of service. You're at a pharmacy. You could ask, is it cheaper to get a generic drug? How much is the cost of this drug? And still walk away with a prescription or with a medication. The concern I have with these plans is that it's a one-size-fits-all approach, and healthcare spending is not one-size-fits-all. As I already mentioned, 20% of the population accounts for 80% of the spending. And it's with conditions like heart disease and cancer and lung disorders and mental disorders, hypertension, diabetes, these 15 conditions alone account for over half of what we spend on healthcare. These 15 conditions alone are where the spending is. And if we don't address the way people with these conditions use the healthcare system, we're not going to realize any savings. And the question is, are these plans sufficient to change the way these types of people with these conditions use the healthcare system? And I would argue that they're not, because in large part, everyone on this chart uses enough healthcare services to be very much above a deductible. So if you have a $1,000 deductible and you use $5,000 worth of healthcare in any given year, what incentive do you have to reduce your healthcare spending? If you reduce it by 20%, $1,000, what do you get out of it? You're not going to save $1,000. You're going to save whatever your coinsurance is on that marginal reduction in spending. So if you reduce your spending or your use by $1,000, if you have a 10% coinsurance rate, you're saving $100. Your insurance company or your employer is saving $900. And when you're talking about people with those conditions, I think it's unlikely to expect them to respond to a coinsurance rate to change their spending. I think we need to do something different for this population. And I think what we need to do different is be innovative. We need to think about what impact these plans are having on people with high-cost conditions. And I'll give you a couple examples. A study done down in Asheville, North Carolina, there's been some publications on this, where they came up with a program on diabetes care. They decided that they were going to eliminate cost sharing for people with diabetes as long as they went through a certain educational program with a pharmacist. And what they found was that when they waived the cost of diabetes treatment, their overall costs went down. They went down because compliance went up and people started taking better care of themselves. It's a real financial incentive in this case. Reduce cost sharing to zero and you get increased compliance. And you can see this middle piece of the bar, the blue piece, over time increased. That's the actual cost of treating diabetes. But all other expenses went down. So that expenses went from over $7,000 in the base year for someone with diabetes to under $5,000 5 years later. Okay, that's one positive outcome. Another positive outcome was that there was an instant reduction in the number of sick days among people with diabetes, a real impact on the bottom line. Okay, something we don't often associate with a health benefits plan. Okay, some other examples that are in here is that reducing co-payments for cholesterol-lowering medication also increases compliance and reduces hospitalizations and would result in a national savings of more than $1 billion. And there's also a paper on the value of antihypertensive therapy in terms of reducing blood pressure and the impact that that would have on life expectancy, as well as the impact on overall health spending. I think we need to look at different innovations and think about how it fits into consumerism. You could do these things in an HRA environment. You can't do them in an HSA environment, because in an HSA environment, the high deductible has to cover everything. There is a provision to allow preventive services to be carved out, but it's ambiguous at best as to what's defined as preventive services. If you have diabetes and you're treating it, are you preventing complications from the disease, or are you treating a disease? It's still unclear as to whether or not you could carve out diabetes care under an HSA. What I want to do for a few minutes, and then I'll wrap this up, is talk about trends in cost sharing, because I believe that cost sharing can be used as a way to induce more consumerism into the system. We've seen deductible levels go up, but that's an oversimplification. What we've really seen is that deductibles for out-of-network services have gone up and are higher than deductibles for in-network services. So what's happening here is employers and insurers are providing people an incentive to use in-network providers. It's giving people a choice. It's showing them the implications of their choice, at least from a cost perspective, in terms of what it's going to cost you if you use an out-of-network provider as opposed to an in-network provider. So it's getting people to think about the kinds of healthcare services, the type of a provider that they're using. We've seen the same kind of trend with prescription drugs, different kinds of tiers, with the more expensive tiers not only more expensive, but increasing faster than the lower cost tiers. So it gets people to think about whether or not they should use a brand name drug, a non-preferred drug, this fourth tier, or some type of generic drug when it's available. I've argued for reducing the generic drug copay to zero. I argue that if you reduce it to zero, you're giving up a $10 or $11 copay, which isn't a whole lot, and you may get enough compliance at that level to more than offset the money you lose from the copayment. And some insurance companies and employers are experimenting with that. Some are offering 3 months of generic drugs with no copayment to get people to try it. And if you think it's not as medically effective, well, then you don't have to stay on it. You could go back to the preferred drug at the preferred drug copayment with no penalty. The other thing employers and insurers are doing is not just about differences in copays, but also where you get your drugs from. What we're starting to see a lot of is that if you get your drugs through the mail, through a mail order pharmacy, you can get a 3 month supply for two copayments. So it's a win-win for the employer, the insurer, as well as the consumer, because it means the consumer's spending less. We've seen some movement to tiered provider networks, and tiered provider networks, which we've seen with both doctors and hospitals, look a lot like the in-network versus out-of-network cost-sharing differences. It's more complicated than that. It's not something I want to go into, but it is another way of getting people to think about the kinds of healthcare services that they're using. And finally, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. In fact, I'm not going to spend any time on it. I would have liked to, but in the interest of time, we decided to cut it out. HSAs are something you could use to save for your expenses in retirement. And there's all kinds of issues there with moving in that direction. We have a couple of papers on the EBRI website, I thought the address is there. It's just hard to read, that I encourage you to take a look at if you really want to be depressed, because it'll give you a sense of how much healthcare is going to cost you in retirement, and it's just not a pretty picture. But it relates back to this whole notion of how consumerism fits into healthcare now in order to help you get to the point where you need to save money for your healthcare expenses in retirement in the future. Time for a couple of questions. I will be here through the end of the day. Well, I think at this point, employers are experimenting. They're jumping, the large employers anyway, are jumping in, but not doing a whole lot in large part to push people into these plans. They want to see how it works. I have one employer on my board that offered an HSA as soon as possible in 2005. And in early 06, he told me that he was proud of the fact that they threw this plan out there. They put it together real fast, no education, no outreach whatsoever. They were proud of the fact that they got 0.1% take up. Okay? They thought that was pretty good, more than they expected, given how fast they threw it out there. And they want to see what happens. They're offering it as an option with the other option. They're not changing anything else around. And over time, they'll look and reevaluate as necessary. Then there's another employer, and I can mention who it is, John Deere, which has been very vocal about what they were doing. They spent a year and a half educating their employees about these plans before offering them. But this year, they went to full replacement. So they took the time to spend, a lot of time to do seminars and to do outreach, and then they just dropped everything they were doing and went to this plan. They truly believe that this is the right way to go. Most employers are not doing that. Small businesses are, because they can't offer a choice. And I think with small businesses, they're just reaching out to do anything to be able to maintain their health benefits, given how fast healthcare costs are increasing. And that's where you see a lot of the numbers. With the large businesses, take-up can vary anywhere from 0.1% to 20% or 30%, depending upon how you price it. I'll give you an example of pricing. When I was in graduate school, at the university, I had a choice of two health plans. One would cost, for family coverage, $200 a month, no cost sharing. So at that point, we'd spend our $200 a month, wouldn't cost us anything to go to the doctor, wouldn't cost anything to go to the hospital, guaranteed $2,400 a year out of our pocket to have the plan, whether we used it or not. The other plan that was offered to us was a high deductible. This is back in 1992. $1,200 each, my wife and myself. Once you hit the $1,200, no out-of-pocket spending. It's a no-brainer. You chose the high deductible. Because at most, you would spend $2,400, but if you didn't use healthcare, you wouldn't. And that was the goal of the university in terms of pricing the plan that way. Everyone in the economics department got it and was on the high deductible plan. There were no accounts at that time. I don't know about the other departments at the time, but you could use premiums to steer people into a kind of plan, and I think employers aren't yet at that point where they're using premiums. If they like what they see over time, then they'll start to use premiums to steer people to those plans, and eventually they'll start to phase out the other plans, just like they did when they moved to managed care and added HMOs and PPOs alongside traditional fee-for-service or indemnity insurance, and eventually phased out the indemnity insurance.